If you eliminate diplomacy, you make war inevitable. And if we do view this conflict as an ideological battle, then it is a zero-sum game that will inevitably end up with one side succeeding over the other. But if we recognize the strategic nature of it, there are possibilities to be able to find a resolution.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. We are pleased today to welcome Dr. Trita Parsi. Dr. Trita Parsi was born in Iran. He grew up in Sweden and earned his PhD in international relations from Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. His dissertation was directed by Frank Fukuyama, who spoke here last year, as well as by former National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski and Virginia's own Rui Ramazani, who is here with us today, all very good friends of the Miller Center. Dr. Parsi has served in senior staff positions on Capitol Hill and at the United Nations, and now serves as president of the National Iranian American Council. He is the author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States, which he based on over 130 face-to-face interviews with senior officials in all three countries. Please welcome Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here at University of Virginia at the Miller Center. And I have to say, I am absolutely delighted to see Professor Ramazani in the audience here today. The work that I've done would absolutely not have been possible in any way, shape, or form without the guidance and support of Professor Ramazani. And also, it is built on the backbone of the research that he has been doing for decades now. It wouldn't have been possible had it not been for the great efforts that he's done. I wanted to just start off explaining how come I ended up writing this book. I started doing my PhD at Johns Hopkins SAIS in August 2001. I had planned to write about Afghanistan because it was a country that I had dealt with a little bit while working at the Security Council, and I felt that it was an understudied subject. But about 12 days later, 9/11 happened, and everyone in Washington overnight became an Afghan expert. So I felt, well, that market has saturated, so I needed to focus on the next most likely potential conflict in the region. And Iran and Israel stood out. I had been working on U.S.-Iran relations for several years, and there always was this Israel factor, the Israel-Iran-U.S. triangle, but so little research had been made into it. And in fact, when I looked into it, I saw that the last book that had been written on the subject was in 1987, more than 20 years ago. It was written by an Israeli journalist by the name of Samuel Segev. It's an excellent book, but it's 20 years old, and there's a lot that has happened ever since. And perhaps more importantly, Segev's book was based exclusively on interviews with Israeli officials or Israeli documents. It did not have access to the Iranian side of the story. And I thought if we could write a dissertation in which interviews with all three sides would be included, it would be a tremendous contribution to the knowledge about this conflict. So I went to Iran, I went to Israel. Since I'm based in D.C., I had good access to American officials, and the work is primarily based on 130 interviews with decision makers in all three countries. Now, before going into the very, at times, sad parts of the history of the three countries, I wanted to just mention something about the human side of the story. When we hear the rhetoric coming out of Tehran, as well as from Washington and Israel, but particularly when we hear the rhetoric about the Holocaust, I think it's important to keep in mind that for more than 2,500 years, relationship between the Iranian people and the Jewish people have more often than not been quite excellent. In 539 BC, Cyrus the Great, the emperor of Persia, the founder of the Persian Empire, freed the Jewish people from the Babylonian captivity. And ever since, about a third of the Jewish population there chose to stay in Babylon, and they are today's Iraqi Jews. Most of them are in Israel now. About a third of them went back to Israel-Palestine, and they rebuilt the second rebuilding of the temple, financed by Persian tax money. And about a third of them emigrated to what was then the world's sole superpower, Persia, and they are today's Iranian Jews. There's still 25,000 Jews living in Iran, the largest Jewish population in the Middle East outside of Israel. And obviously there's a large number of Israelis of Iranian background as well. I'm going to read you a short passage from the book dealing with that issue. Some 200,000 Iranian Jews and their descendants live in Israel. Some of them belong to the highest levels of the Israeli political elite. In the Islamic Republic, these individuals would never have been able to excel in their careers. Long before reaching prominence, they would have been stopped by the glass ceiling that separates religious minorities, seculars, and disbelievers from those considered to be capable of being loyal to the Islamic Republic. Current Israeli President Moshe Katsav is actually not current anymore, and Deputy Prime Minister Shaul Mofaz were both born in Iran. The recently resigned IDF Chief of Staff, Dan Chalutz, was born to Persian immigrants. When Katsav worked at the UN, a favorite pastime of his was to embarrass Iranian diplomats at various events by seeking to converse with them in Persian. Forbidden to talk to Israeli officials, at least in public, the Iranian diplomats could rid themselves of the unrelenting Katsav only by leaving the events. Katsav found that profoundly amusing. Mofaz and Chalutz approach Iran with a bit less humor, however. They are some of the most hawkish Israeli leaders regarding Iran. When asked in a press conference in January 2005 how far Israel will go to stop Iran's nuclear program, Chalutz, a former pilot, gave a chilling response: 2,000 kilometers. That's the distance between Iran and Israel. Now I'm going to give you a quote. The quote is, "Iran is Israel's best friend, and we do not intend to change our position in relation to Tehran." It's a quote from an Israeli prime minister, but it is not from Ben-Gurion in the 1950s or 60s. It's not from Golda Meir in the 1970s. It's Yitzhak Rabin from 1987. Ayatollah Khomeini was still alive, and he was still calling Israel a cancerous tumor in the region that needed to be removed. I wanted to give you that quote to exemplify the complexity of Israeli-Iranian relations, a complexity that we oftentimes miss out on by focusing too much on the rhetoric and on the ideology. When you scratch the surface, you see a strategic rivalry that has emerged between Israel and Iran since the end of the Cold War that is driving the current conflict, in which ideology is used by all sides to be able to conceal the true intentions and the true interests of these states. And I'll show you why. Take a step back. In the 1960s and 70s, Iran and Israel were pushed together because they had common security imperatives. Both states shared a sense of threat from the Arab world as well as from the Soviet Union. These factors were critical in pushing the two countries together and gave birth to the Israeli doctrine of the periphery, the idea that Israel's security was best achieved by creating alliances with the non-Arab states in the periphery of the Middle East in order to balance the Arab states of the vicinity. For the Israelis, Iran, together with Turkey and Ethiopia, was a critical periphery state. The Iranians as well recognized the utility of having some sort of entente with Israel in order to offset the threat from the Soviet Union and from the Arab states. But their interests were still quite different because the Israelis like to advertise the relationship as much as possible, show the world that Israel actually had managed to create decent relations with a major Muslim nation. The Iranians, however, wanted to keep this as secret as possible. They went to great lengths to ensure that the outside world, particularly the Arab world, would know as little of this as possible, though they failed. But they built, for instance, a special tarmac at Tehran airport, far, far away from the central terminal, where only the Israeli airplanes could land, as long far away as possible so no one would notice how many Al Al planes were actually landing in Tehran. The Israeli Prime Minister, when he was visiting Iran in the 70s, he always arrived at night and he wore a wig to make sure that no one would be able to recognize him. In the Iranian Foreign Ministry's own papers, they even didn't refer to their mission in Israel as their mission in Israel. They call it Bern 2, the second mission that they had to burn Switzerland's capital, a very, very tiny state, but that still had managed to deserve to have two missions from Iran. And the reason was that the Iranians did not want to unnecessarily attract some of the anger from the Arab world that was directed towards Israel. The fear was that if it was made too public and if they became too close to Israel, they would unnecessarily be able to bring much of that Arab energy towards themselves, and they wanted to avoid it. Now, there is an impression that Israeli-Iranian relations changed dramatically in 1979 because of the Islamic Revolution. And certainly, there was a revolution in Iran, an entirely new government with an entirely new ideology at the state level. But Iran and Israel's strategic imperatives and the geostrategic context that they found themselves in did not change that much. In fact, for Iran, it changed in such a way that the utility and the necessity of having some relationship with Israel behind the scene even increased. Because the Soviet Union was still a threat, the Arab world was still a threat both to Iran and to Israel, and to Iran, it was not just a theoretical threat anymore. With the invasion of Saddam Hussein of Iran in 1980, the Arab world had become a real threat. And beyond that, the Iranians had managed, due to the hostage crisis and other things, to also turn the United States into an enemy. So now Iran was paradoxically in even greater need of Israel than it was in the 1970s. And the Israelis were very keen on making sure that their relationship with Iran would not change in spite of the revolution. They had in the past managed to retain a positive relationship with another periphery state, even though that periphery state went through a regime change and even switched camps in the Cold War. That was Ethiopia. And the Israelis went to great lengths to try to make sure that they had good relations with Iranians. Only a few days after Saddam Hussein invaded Iran in 1980, the Deputy the Defense Minister of Israel held a press conference in which he urged the United States to put the past behind it and help Iran keep up its defenses. This was said at a time when 52 American diplomats were still held hostage in Iran. The divergence between Israeli and American interests vis-a-vis Iran was getting greater and greater. The Israelis were fearing that if Iran lost, Saddam Hussein would become a very powerful state, and the idea of the Eastern Front, the idea that Iraq would join an Arab alliance against Israel, could materialize, and it would be a very, very powerful enemy towards Israel. They needed Iran as a periphery power to balance Iraq and to drain the energy of Iraq towards east instead of allowing Iraq to look westwards. And they went to great lengths using their access to American spare parts to be able to sell that to the Iranians. The Iranians had an almost entirely American-built army, and during the war, because of the American arms embargo, they had great difficulties being able to buy the spare parts. There were basically two countries they could turn to: Vietnam, who had a lot of American spare parts left throughout their nation, as well as Israel. And the Israelis were utilizing that extensively to show to Iran that Israel was still a strategic asset for the Iranians. The Iranians, at the same time, had now a new ideology, one in which they wanted to be the leader of the Islamic world. They were talking about the Islamic bloc and being an Iran being able to overcome not only the Arab-Persian divide, but also the Sunni-Shiite divide, and to do so by using political Islam. Even prior to the revolution, the Iranians had felt this contradiction in their security outlook. In the short term, they needed Israel to balance the Arabs. In the long term, they recognized that their security was best achieved by befriending their permanent Arab and Sunni neighbors. And one way of doing so was to play the anti-Israeli card. Even the Shah, in spite of his strong relations with Israel, occasionally used that card. But now, of course, after the revolution, it became a much more frequently used instrument in Iranian foreign policy. In many ways, the Iranians were using the rhetoric against Israel, which was now at an extremely high level, to conceal the fact that in reality, they weren't really taking any specific measures against Israel. They needed the Israelis for their security imperatives, but for their ideological and strategic objectives down the road, they needed to make sure that Iran was portrayed as this pan-Islamic state that was standing up for the cause of Islam and standing up for the Palestinian issue. And to do so by using a rhetoric that was far, far more radical than the rhetoric used by any Arab state at the time. And in many occasions, their rhetoric was going hand in hand in an inverse relationship with their policy. When the PLO was getting increasingly frustrated that the Iranian revolution had not created a strong ally of the Palestinians against Israel, and they were criticizing Ayatollah Khomeini for a lack of support for the Palestinian cause, the Iranian response was heighten the rhetoric, call for a new parade in favor of the Palestinian cause, calling for instance, the Jerusalem Day, Al-Quds Day, that was inaugurated in 1981 in Iran, was a direct result of Iran being criticized by the Palestinians for not doing enough to help them. So the response was put on a parade. Have Iranians march through the streets of Tehran calling for Jerusalem to be the United Arab capital. And by that, conceal the fact that in reality, Iran was pursuing a completely different policy. And this was well appreciated by the Israelis because contrary to today, back then in the 1980s, it was the Israelis that were lobbying Washington to talk to Iran. It was the Israelis who were lobbying Washington to sell arms to Iran. And it was the Israelis who were lobbying Washington not to pay attention to Iranian rhetoric because Iranian rhetoric was not reflective of policy, the argument was. This later on spilled into the Iran-Contra scandal, an Israeli initiative at the outset, in an effort to bring Iran back into the Western fold, get the United States and Iran on talking terms again. What really changed the relationship, however, is the 1991-1993 period and the end of the Cold War and the reconfiguration of the geopolitical map in the Middle East. The two factors that had pushed Iran and Israel closer together more or less evaporated. The Soviet threat was no longer there because the Soviet Union collapsed. And Iraq, the last standing Arab army capable of posing a conventional military threat to both Iran and to Israel, was defeated in the Persian Gulf War led by the United States and a UN coalition. So now you had a completely new security environment. In many ways, the environment of Iran and Israel had both improved. But at the same time, they now found themselves unchecked. Just as much as Iran was needed to balance Iraq, to a certain extent, the Israelis felt that Iraq was also needed to balance Iran. And there was no longer a powerful Iran, in their view, that could do so. And there was a sense that now the periphery doctrine had truly become obsolete. And the real threat to Israel, at least in the future, potentially, would no longer be the Arab vicinity, but the Persian periphery. And this was particularly true because of the way that the Persian Gulf War itself was conducted. The United States at the time was spending a tremendous amount of political capital assembling within the international coalition against Saddam an Arab coalition against Saddam. And to do so, they basically had to meet two criteria. On the one hand, they had to promise the Arabs that if they help fight Saddam and get him out of Kuwait alongside the United States would put pressure on Israel after the war to come to some compromises with the Palestinians. And secondly, in order to make sure that the Arabs were part of the coalition, Israel needed to be kept out. And this was creating a tremendous amount of anxiety in Israel, because now Israel was starting to feel that in the post-Cold War world, it was no longer being an asset to the United States, it was treated as a burden. The United States went to great lengths to ensure that the Israelis would not join the coalition or retaliate against Saddam. And Saddam obviously fully understood this dynamic, part of the reason why he fired 34 Scud missiles at Israel in the hope that the Israelis would retaliate, and their retaliation would immediately have caused most of the Arab states to walk out of the coalition because they could not fight another Arab nation alongside of Israel. And this created a fear that now in the post-Cold War world, the United States was cozying up to the Arabs, treating Israel to a certain extent as a burden. And on top of that, if the United States and Iran were to have a rapprochement, where would that leave Israel in America's strategic outlook? There was a fear now in Israel that if a dialogue between the United States and Iran were to take place, and if a deal were to be reached between the Americans and the Iranians, the deal would to a large extent come at the expense of Israel's security interest. What is interesting is that this shift then in Israeli outlook coincides not with an ideological shift in Iran, but rather with a geostrategic shift in the region, as well as a plummeting of Iran's ideological zeal. Because at this point, the Iranians were actually doing quite a lot to de-ideologize their foreign policy and reach out to the United States. They had, throughout the Persian Gulf War, taken several measures in the hope that that would be helpful to the United States, and in return, the United States would seek better relations with Iran after the war. They had opened up a channel of communication with the United States behind the scenes. They had permitted the United States to use Iranian airspace against Iraq. And perhaps most importantly, after the war, when the Shiites in the south were rising against Saddam, they resisted the temptation of putting any fuel on that fire, and that earned much appreciation from the Bush senior administration. The Secretary of State at the time, James Baker, at one point made a reference saying that in the post-war security order of the region, a new architecture should be built and Iran should be included in it. That was music to the ears of the Iranians. This was their opportunity to be able to come in back from the cold, to be reintegrated into the political and security architecture of the region. And this was what was guiding their policy at the time, trying to prove themselves as an asset to the United States and show that they could take steps that were quite in contrast to what their ideology otherwise would say. But now, because of the shift, the Israelis were fearing that a rapprochement between the U.S. and Iran would be very bad for the Israelis. And now in 1992, October of that year, you had a sudden shift in Israel's posture towards Iran. In October that year, that's when Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin start to use a very, very harsh rhetoric against Iran. For the first time, the Israelis start to depict Iran as a global threat and as an existential threat. Throughout the 1980s, in spite of Iran's rhetoric against Israel, the Israelis had shown tremendous constraint, and they had not been referring to Iran as a threat to begin with, and certainly not as a global or existential threat. But because of the changing strategic environment, the calculation now in Israel was quite different. There was an inversement of the periphery doctrine. Labor government, once they won the elections in June 1992, felt that they needed to take some swift action in order to regain Israel's strategic position in Washington. And that necessitated agreeing to a peace process, pursuing a peace process with the Palestinians, because that was what the Americans wanted at the time, and then at the same time make the argument that the new threat to the region was Iran and Islamic fundamentalism, particularly Shiite fundamentalism. And that would cause Israel to regain that strategic significance, because Israel was needed in order to fight that Shiite fundamentalism, a position that the Israelis had not at all taken throughout the 1980s. And originally, when they were making that case, that was raising a lot of eyebrows in Washington, because it was a position 100% opposite of what Israel was taking only 5 years earlier. And the only thing that had actually changed was that Iran actually had become more moderate and more eager to work with the West. I have a quote from one of the Israelis at the time who was describing the situation. "There was a feeling in Israel that because of the end of the Cold War, relations with the U.S. were cooling and we needed some new glue for the alliance. And the new glue was radical Islam. And Iran was radical Islam." So now suddenly you have a new situation, in which the Iranians and the Israelis both start to undermine U.S. foreign policy measures in the region that they felt were beneficial to the other. From the Israeli perspective, obstacles were put in place in order to ensure that there would not be a dialogue between the U.S. and Iran, there would not be a rapprochement, fearing that that would come at Israel's security expense. From the Iranian side, once it became clear that the United States would not reciprocate what the Iranians believed were a very significant support that Iran had provided the United States, and that the United States, together with Israel, would be pursuing a peace process that they perceived to be an effort to create an Israel-centric Middle East order based on Iran's prolonged isolation, that's the time that they turn to Palestinian rejectionist forces and they start beginning supporting terror against Israel, with the calculation that the weakest link in the American strategy was the peace process. Without a successful peace process, none of the other objectives of the United States in the region would be achieved, and there would not be a new order in the region based on Iran's prolonged isolation. And according to Martin Indyk, who was a critical person in the Clinton administration at the time, a person who was instrumental in not only pushing for the peace process, but for pushing for dual containment, the idea that Iran must be contained in the region, he believed that the Iranians did not necessarily get it wrong. This is what he said. The Iranians had every incentive to oppose the peace process. Our strategy was to, on the one hand, use the engine of peacemaking to transform the region, and on the other hand, contain the Iranians through sanctions and isolation. The two were symbiotic. The more we succeeded in making peace, the more isolated they would become. The more we succeeded in containing the Iranians, the more possible it would be to make peace. So they had an incentive to do us in on the peace process in order to defeat our policy of containment and isolation. And therefore, they took aim at the peace process. Now, I didn't get any Iranian officials to necessarily admit straightforward that this is exactly what they were trying to do. But I do have one important person in Iran who said something that I think is quite reflective of what their thinking was at the time. He said that Iran preferred Likud to Labor because Likud was not pursuing a peace process based on Iran's isolation and exclusion. Until this day, Shimon Peres believes that the four major terrorist bombings that took place in Israel in 1996, March and April of that year, only weeks before the elections that brought Netanyahu to power, that these bombings were directed by the Iranians with the explicit aim of making sure that Labor would be unseated and that Netanyahu would come to power and that that would put an end to the peace process. Whether Peres is right or wrong, I think it is quite clear to say that Netanyahu coming to power was a critical measure that did put an end to the peace process. And interestingly enough, when Netanyahu did come to power for the first 9 months, he actually reached out extensively to the Iranians. His thinking was that the peace process with the Palestinians is not possible. Israel can never achieve a real peace with the Palestinians. And as a result, it needs to keep the door open for a better relationship with Iran as a periphery power. And the argument on the Likud side was that the Labor Party had pursued a very counterproductive policy because it would, A, not be able to get a peace deal with the Palestinians that was sustainable, and at the same time, in the pursuit of that peace process, the Labor Party had turned Iran unnecessarily into an enemy. Now, the Iranians were not interested in any peace deals with the Israelis at the time, but there are numerous occasions in which there has been a tremendous amount of outreach between the countries. One critical example, I think, is what happened in 2003. In May of that year, the Iranian government sent a proposal to the U.S. government through the Swiss ambassador in Tehran, who had been tasked by the U.S. government to be the official go-between. Within the framework of that proposal, it was a proposal for basically addressing all the issues between the two countries, with the exception of human rights in Iran. Within the framework of that proposal, the Iranians offered to cooperate against all terrorist organizations, above all Al-Qaeda. Open up the nuclear issue for full transparency. Help the United States in Iraq ensure that it would not have sectarian government in Iraq, something the Iranians successfully had helped the U.S. with in Afghanistan only a year and a half earlier. But perhaps most importantly, end all support for Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Turn Hezbollah into a mere political organization, meaning its disarmament. And potentially sign on to the Beirut Declaration, the Saudi peace plan, the idea that the entire Arab world would recognize Israel in return for an Israeli recognition of an Arab state. The proposal went to the Bush administration. There was no response. There was a tremendous amount of confidence in the United States at the time, particularly since Iraq had been defeated in 3 years. And the argument was that whatever the United States could get from negotiations with Iran, and this was basically a laundry list of everything the United States would like Iran to do, it could get even more by simply removing the government in Tehran. What is less known is that only a couple of weeks before this proposal went to the United States, the Iranians sent a senior official to a conference in Europe, sponsored by the an American university funded by the Pentagon, which attracts about 200 to 300 people from the region and Europe that all work in security in those countries. The Iranians deliberately sent this person, the head of the IRGC, former head, Mohsen Rezai, to put forward this idea, the framework of the idea of a new relationship between the United States and Iran. The reason why they sent him to this conference particularly was because there was always a very large number of Israelis at that conference. And the key target in the audience were the Israelis. The aim was most likely, and I have good reasons to believe, to send Israel the signal that if there was a deal between the United States and Iran, it would not come at Israel's expense because Iran would be forced to change its policies vis-a-vis Israel in order to be able to get a better relationship with Washington. Now, some people are saying this is spilled milk, that this proposal may not be on the table anymore. This is all in the past. But I think it's critical to understand this because it shows how the Iranians have used the Israel card as a strategic card, which they're willing to trade away at the right time, at the right place, at the right price. If it was an ideological battle, you would not have seen these shifts in Israeli-Iranian relations take place at the times that they did take place. And this is critical to understand because some people right now are saying that it's 1938 and Iran is Germany. And then they go on to imply that Ahmadinejad is Hitler. If we accept the premises of this analogy, that indeed it is 1938, Iran indeed is Germany, and Ahmadinejad is Hitler, then which decision maker in his or her right mind would like to play the role of Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister that thought that he could negotiate with the Germans? This is an analogy that is deliberately aimed at eliminating diplomacy from the table. And if you eliminate diplomacy, you make war inevitable. And if we do view this conflict as an ideological battle, then it is a zero-sum game that will inevitably end up with one side succeeding over the other. But if we recognize the strategic nature of it, then at least there are possibilities to be able to find a resolution. And I think if you take a look at the history, particularly the behind-the-scenes dealings, there are ample of evidence of opportunities and for a successful peacemaking, at least finding some sort of a modus vivendi between Iran and Israel. Thank you so much.
Let me invite those who have questions that they would like to ask of Dr. Trita Parsi to queue up in the back of the room and meet me there, and we'll take as many questions as we have time for. Dr. Parsi, the policy of the United States, at least as enunciated by the President, starting with his 2002 State of the Union message, has had two main goals. One is, as you've mentioned, the removal of the theocratic government and replacing that with some sort of liberal democracy. And the second is to prevent Iran from acquiring or maintaining nuclear weapons. More recently, the policy seems to have expanded to include a recognition that we will need the support, at least the cooperation of Iran to secure any sort of stable peace in Iraq. Could you comment on sort of how you believe these three goals will be playing out over the next year or so?
Thank you. Thank you so much. I think particularly because of the first objectives that you mentioned, there has been a tremendous amount and still remains a tremendous amount of mistrust between the two countries. And this goes both ways. For the United States, for good reasons, have a lot of mistrust against the Iranian government. And at the same time, the Iranian government have their reasons as well. And I think we've reached a stage in which, particularly on the Iranian side, they're waiting for a signal of strategic intent from the United States. I don't foresee the Iranians being terribly helpful for the United States unless there is a signal of strategic intent that the United States is willing to recognize Iran as a legitimate power in the region and treat its legitimate security interests as legitimate. And part of the reason why the Iranians are going to be likely difficult to put any help up front without getting that strategic intent is because of the experience that they had in Afghanistan. After 9/11, the Iranians offer the United States and provide the United States with a tremendous amount of support in Afghanistan. According to James Dobbins, the representative of President Bush himself, to the talks in Afghanistan, the United States did not assemble an alliance against the Taliban. The United States joined an existing alliance against the Taliban that had been put together by Iran, funded by Iran, and armed by Iran. And Iran was providing critical advice, military advice, during the war, but perhaps most importantly, after the war, once the United States had won, it was thanks to Iran that the United States won the peace. Because it was the Iranians that had the influence and the connections with the winning parties in Afghanistan and put pressure on them to compromise and go for a power-sharing deal in which the presidency was given to a Pashto and not to a Tajik. 6 weeks after the Bonn conference, in which the Iranians and the Americans worked very closely together, it was Ambassador Dobbins, as well as I think Crocker was involved in it as well, President Bush put Iran into the axis of evil. Tehran was in shock. The arguments of the pragmatic elements in Iran had been, if you help the United States, if you show your strategic utility and the fact that Iran can be a strategic asset, the United States will reciprocate. That turned out not to be the case, because at the time, the Bush administration was guided by a doctrine called the Hadley Doctrine, meaning that the United States would tactically cooperate with rogue nations, but it would never let the tactical cooperation translate into a strategically different relationship, meaning that Iran's help would be accepted as long as it was needed, and as long as it was no longer needed, the United States would go back to towards having a very hostile relationship with the Iranians. So now, when it comes to the nuclear issue, when it comes to Iraq, when it comes to any other issue, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, the Iranians are looking for a signal of strategic intent. Are the Americans looking for tactical cooperation, after which the hostilities will resume, or are they looking for a strategically redefined relationship with Iran?
Thank you very much for your talk this morning. I'm very interested in the relationship between the Iranian government and the Shia in Iraq. One's led to believe by most of the accounts that the Shia in Iraq, in the southern part around Basra and in the swampy region, during the 80s, in the struggle between Iran and Iraq, remained loyal, even if they were had difficulties with the Saddam government, remained loyal to Iraq. I'd like your comment on that, please. And if what really is the relationship between the government of Iran and the Shia in Iraq today? Are they supporting, as many accounts suggest, a greater role for Iran in a post-Saddam Iraq, or are they just what are they doing?
Thank you. One of the things that we shouldn't forget is that at the end of the day, there's probably no other country in the region that would benefit and have an interest in an Iraqi democracy as much as the Iranians, particularly at the early stages, because democracy in Iraq will basically be a census. And in one census, in that type of a census, the Shiites will be in a very, very powerful position in Iraq. And for the Iranians, this is critical. Because during the Iraq-Iran war, about 1 million casualties, 8-year-long war, the Iranians cannot ever afford to have another government in Iraq that they think will be hostile or will be a tool of the Westerners. This is their perspective, that would be used against Iran. And by the way, this is shared by many Shiite Iraqi officials who believe that the Iraq went to war with Iran in 1990 at the request, or at least at the tacit green light, of the United States. And they don't want to see Iraq become a battleground for U.S.-Iranian enmity and rivalry in the future. I think what the Iranians have done in Iraq is that they have invested in basically almost every possible candidate that will take over that country in the future, with the exception of some of the most extremist Sunni elements. But they have excellent relations with most of the Shiite factions, as well as the Kurds. Most of these people spent part, if not large parts, of the last 20 years in Iraq. Their children were born in Iran. They grew up speaking Farsi and learning Farsi, went through the Iranian educational system. So they have, for natural reasons, very strong relations with many elements inside of Iran. Now, does that mean that the Iranians are going to constantly be using this in order to fuel tensions and other things in Iraq? I doubt it. from the Iranian perspective, if they can get the Shiites to be able to be a majority bloc in Iraq, that would be their best bet, their best way of making sure that that country that for thousands of years have been a strategic rival of Iran is more or less neutralized. They certainly do not have an interest in seeing the country being partitioned, because that would mean that they would have one-third of a friend rather than having one the entire Iraqi state being a country that is positively inclined towards Iran.
Very interesting presentation. I compliment you on how articulate you are. My interest is American public opinion's attitude towards Iran. And it goes back to the taking of the hostages, which you recall. And my question is this. Why did the Ayatollahs at the time permit these youngsters to take over the embassy and to take those hostages? And why is it impossible for any Iranian government apparently today to apologize for that? It seems to me that if that happened, American public opinion would be much more favorable to accepting some kind of a rapprochement.
Thank you. Clearly, the hostage crisis is on the minds of the American people. And it's fascinating to me because, as a country, we're not necessarily a country that remembers a lot of things. But this one, we certainly do remember. And I'm not saying bad or good, it's just a reality. This one, we not only remember, we're constantly reminded of. I think what happened in that period was something we should be very, very cautious about, which is that in these radical situations, when order is no longer there, elements who wants to come to power fear most to be out-radicalized by other elements. And if we were to have a sudden change of regime in Iran right now, don't expect the pro-democracy movement to be able to be there to take control if order is lost. On the contrary, you will have the most radical elements in Iran once again being able to set the agenda. And that seems to have been the case in 1980. In which Ayatollah Khomeini was very much afraid of being out-radicalized by other elements, being out-radicalized by elements which show themselves to be more capable of standing up to the United States. And this is something we have to keep in back of our minds when some people in Washington are hoping for what they call creative chaos. Create some chaos and hope that the best will come out of it. Usually, it's the worst that comes out of it. The second part of the question was, would it really change public opinion in the United States? I'm not so sure. I think that there are a tremendous amount of factors that is complicating U.S.-Iran relations. I think that the American people at the end of the day are tremendously forgiving people. They have recognized that time has passed. The American people doesn't seem to hold much anger against the Vietnamese people, even though 50,000 American soldiers were killed in Vietnam. Not a single one of the diplomats that were taken hostage completely erroneously were, at the end of the day, killed. They're all back in the United States. So I'm not so sure that that factor is as great. I think there are elements who may want to constantly use that to be able to prevent a rapprochement from taking place. It doesn't mean that it wouldn't be tremendously helpful if the Iranians came out and apologized. I think that would be a very positive thing. And to a certain extent, President Khatami did that, when he expressed regret for the hostage-taking in his interview with Christian Amanpour only months after he was elected into office. At the time, that made the headlines. A lot of people were happy to see it. I think Iran could definitely go much further in making it much more clear that they really, truly regret and they apologize for that, just as much as the United States also can apologize for the support that the U.S. provided Iraq during the time of the Iraq-Iran War or the 1953 coup. The main point is that there's enough blame to go around. If we constantly look at the back, we're always going to be able to find reasons as to why we should be more angry at the other side and then they should be at us.
Is there a balance of power within Iran today, say, between the Ahmadinejad faction, the generally moderate, as I understand it, general public, and the mullahs? And if so, can they offset one another in any way?
Thank you. I think to a large extent, they're constantly offsetting each other in such a way that it's very difficult for any one faction to pursue a consistent policy. The internal infighting in Iran is quite extensive, and it's been so for quite some time. I think what is important to keep in mind in that context, though, is that if we would like to see the more pragmatic elements in Iran to be victorious, if we would like to see the pro-democracy elements that are on the ground fighting, taking small steps to advance the cause of democracy in Iran, we have to keep in mind that their space for maneuverability has been almost eliminated due to the tensions between the U.S. and Iran. The higher the tensions become between the two countries, their space gets smaller and smaller. And the government in Iran, the hardline elements, use the tensions between the two countries as a pretext to be able to clamp down on any internal dissent, including the pro-democracy voices and the NGOs. And we've seen that in the last couple of months. We've seen how 150,000 people have been arrested because they wore the wrong clothes. We've seen how so many NGOs in Iran have been closed down or been put under tremendous amount of pressure. And it's all taking place within the context of the tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Had it not been for those tensions, it would have been much more difficult for the Iranian hardline elements to pursue successfully these policies. And the same is true for making sure that the pragmatist in Iran can have a greater voice. The example I gave earlier on was a perfect example of showing that when the United States did not reciprocate, those elements in Iran who want to pursue a better policy lose out. What happened after Axis of Evil was that the elements in Iran who were arguing that instead, that the only way you can actually force the United States to come to the table and recognize Iran is not by being helpful. It's not by offering goodwill gestures. It's by making it as costly as possible for the United States to refuse to do so. And I think if we take a look at what's happened after 2003 till today, we've seen a significant and continuous hardening of the Iranian position because the calculation is you won't get anywhere with goodwill gestures anyways.
Dr. Parsi, the next question comes from Professor William Quandt, who was a senior staff member at the National Security Council during the 1970s.
But I didn't deal with Iran in those days, thank goodness. Thank you for an excellent analysis. I'd like you to draw a little bit on your interviews with Israelis, who presumably talked to you about how they perceive Iran. We've recently heard, particularly from the Walton Mearsheimer book about the role of the pro-Israeli community in this country, that the pro-Israeli sentiment was to push the Americans into a confrontational stance towards Saddam Hussein and to urge them to go to war. A lot of Israelis have said that really isn't so true, that if they had had a choice to make at that point, they would have urged the United States to focus more on Iran rather than Iraq. I'm not so sure I understand the split within the Israeli side, but could you tell us a little bit about what you found? And then what do you make of the current discussions about the United States and Iran and Israel beginning to coordinate military strategy toward Iran? Is that serious or is it more like kind of propaganda and a bluff?
Thank you so much, Professor Khan. It's a great pleasure to see you in the audience and finally get an opportunity to meet you as well. My interviews with Israeli officials as well as with officials in the Bush administration actually showed that Israel was not very happy about going after Iraq and that the argument that was made initially was that Iraq is only a secondary threat, Iran is a primary threat. This was a debate that had been taking place in Israel since the end of the end of the Cold War. Which is the primary threat, Iran or Iraq? And more often than not, those arguing that Iran, the Persian periphery, will be the greatest threat were winning. What happened, though, according to people in the administration I've spoken to, is that once the Israelis realized that the United States and the neoconservatives have basically made up their mind. They were going to go after Saddam Hussein no matter what. The decision was to be supportive of it in the hope that the United States afterwards would go after Iran. And there's even a quote by Ariel Sharon in which he said it flat out, "The minute Iraq has been defeated, we should go after Iran." And that was the calculation. Some of the arguments in Walton Mearsheimer's book, I personally, and having worked in Congress at the time, I didn't recognize. I certainly believe that the Israelis ended up being very supportive, but that was at the second level. It was not at the initial level. At the initial stage, they were actually hoping that the United States would pursue a different policy. As to the threat of military force against Iran by the United States or Israel, if I take Israel first, I don't see the likelihood of an Israeli strike being very, very high for numerous reasons. A, Israel does not have the military capability to be able to take out the Iranian program successfully. It's one thing to attack it. It's another thing to actually be able to destroy it. And there's been some speculation saying, well, perhaps Israel would attack, ultimately fail, and by that force the United States to step in and finish the job. And this has been seriously considered by a lot of people. I also believe that that probably is not that likely, because part of Israel's deterrence is the ambiguity about what it can and cannot do. Israel wants the outside world not really to know what it can and cannot achieve. If the Israelis do attack and ultimately fail, they will have revealed to the world the limits of their capability, and that is a big blow to Israel's deterrence. I think currently Israel is in a state of strategic paralysis. It is playing the chess game as if the chess game has not changed. They're on autopilot. They're playing it as if Hezbollah didn't come out victorious last year. They're playing it as if the United States has not become significantly weakened in Iraq. They're playing it as if Iran does not already have 3,000 centrifuges. And part of it is because the Israeli plan A was to make sure that we would not end up in this situation, that we would not end up in a situation in which, in a negotiation between the United States and Iran, most likely the U.S. would have to accept some limited enrichment capability on Iranian soil. But that is the reality right now. But it's very difficult for the Israelis to come out and switch from plan A to plan B. A, because it would be politically very difficult inside, and already Olmert's government is extremely weak. But B, also because the Israelis fear that if they come out and say what they actually do believe in their hearts of hearts, that Iran is deterrable, that Iran is rational, and that Iran would not be an existential threat because Israel has so much more firepower, the pressure would be off of the United States to pursue plan A. And they're in a state right now not really knowing what to do. And you can see it because elements outside of the Israeli government who don't have to pay the political price for this, are coming out and saying these things. Shlomo Ben Ami, the former foreign minister who's also endorsed the book, has come out and said this. Ephraim Halevi, the former head of the Mossad, extensively quoted in my book, 40 years of experience in the Mossad, came out in the Washington Post only about 3 weeks ago, saying things that Israelis never would say publicly otherwise. Iran is rational. Israel can deal and handle a nuclear Iran even. It is not an existential threat. If Israel were to start saying these things publicly, officially, a lot of pressure would be off of the United States to pursue much harsher policies, and that's what they're afraid of. But in reality, more and more people in Israel are realizing that the current policy going on autopilot would actually end up being very, very negative for Israel as well.
I wish I were a Fred Hitch or Professor Ramazani. I would not have to ask this question or make this statement. You are a very articulate and excellent speaker, and I want to thank you for coming here and giving us, those of us like me who are not well informed about the issue of Iran, so much hope, and definitely so much hope that we don't have to have an Iran war after the Iraq war. But I must say that it sounds a little bit too simple. And maybe that's an unfair statement, as I say, if I knew what Fred knew and some of the other academics know. But I'm definitely interested in getting your book and sort of looking at it in a little different light.
Well, it's deliberately designed in such a way so everyone would feel that they would have to read the book to get the full picture. But thank you for your comment. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your remarks. Being a pragmatist that I am, and hopefully, if ever, one day soon, there will be peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. How do you think that would change the total picture with Iran, Turkey, the total Arab world, and the United States?
Thank you. This has been the strategic gambit since 1992. Rabin came out and he explicitly said, we need to make peace with the Palestinians and in the inner circle because we cannot afford to be at odds with the Arabs while at the same time being odds at the, with Iran down the road. So we need to change at least one of these two. And the effort was in the early 1990s to be able to pursue that, the argument being that if the Palestinian-Israeli conflict were to be resolved, a major strategic card of the Iranians would have been taken away from them. Iran would have been weakened, and it would be much, much easier to be able to come to terms with them or impose on them some other form of solution. It failed in the 1990s, and it failed at a time when the United States was at the apex of its power, both militarily and diplomatically. The Cold War had ended. The United States was the sole superpower of the world. Diplomatically, it was at a better place than it probably ever had been before. And Iran was actually quite weak. Iran had just emerged out of the Iraq-Iran war. It had not been able to reconstruct its economy. But even under those circumstances, an effort to be able to create an order in the region based on Iran's exclusion provided the Iranians with the incentives to target the peace process. And even though they were very weak, the peace process is not a very difficult thing to derail. And now we're faced with a completely different situation. Now the United States is not at the apex of its diplomatic or military power in the region. And Iran is not that weak anymore. On the contrary, it's a rising state. Yet we're pursuing the same strategy. We're inviting the same people to Annapolis that we invited to Madrid. And we're not inviting the same people to Annapolis that we didn't invite to Madrid. And we're expecting that under these much worse situations, we would be able to achieve an objective that we failed to achieve under much more generous conditions. I don't want to be skeptical about peacemaking, but if we're trying to make peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, primarily to beat back Iran, then I don't think we will achieve it. I don't think we would have been able to achieve a stable Europe if we, after World War II, had approached Europe by saying, we're going to create an order in Europe based on Germany's exclusion. Doesn't matter whether we like the government on Iran or not, I don't see it being possible and sustainable to create a stable Middle East by excluding some of the most powerful states of that region, because they are powerful enough, even in their weakest state, to undermine U.S. policies.
Can you comment on the Russian role in this situation?
Thank you. That's a good transition to the last question. I think Putin's visit to Tehran is far more significant than Syria's attendance in Annapolis. The fact that the Russians, let me take a step back. The Iranians have had 500 years of tensions with the Russian state, whether it was Russia or whether it was the Soviet Union. In 1996, I think it was, the Iranian foreign minister, Ali Akbar Velayati, made a statement saying that Russian-Iranian relations had never been this good in 500 years. And he was not exaggerating. This was after the Cold War and with Yeltsin coming into power. But the Iranians are always wary of the Russians. And if you remember in 1995, when the United States first were considering imposing sanctions on Iran and eliminating the trade that existed, one of the arguments that were being made was, if we sanction Iran, if we isolate Iran, we're going to push Iran into the arms of Russia. And that's exactly what's happened. Now the Russians and the Iranians are much closer than they were before, against the will of the Iranians themselves. They don't want to be in Russia's orbit. They don't want to be in Russia's sphere of influence. But that is happening. And I think in the long run, for the United States, that is not good from a geopolitical standpoint. Russia is right now one of the biggest winners of the nuclear conflict. Any outcome short of war and short of a U.S.-Iran agreement benefits the Russians. It raises the price of oil. That's great for Putin. It raises Russia's diplomatic profile. It makes Russia indispensable to the United States in a region that is absolutely critical to U.S. national security.
I'd like to thank Dr. Parsi for shedding light on one of the more important and difficult issues.
Thank you so much.